I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC, and this is the news.
Stage set and mics ready to mute. Tonight, who has the most to gain and what might look a little different in this final presidential debate?
It's getting worse.
Historic wildfires. Flames explode in Colorado. 6,000 acres burning every hour. An entire town forced to evacuate.
We are not going to tolerate foreign interference in our elections.
Election security. The feds say Iran and Russia tried to interfere. What this means for your vote and our nation's safety. Plus, new research shows masks do work. But which face coverings block COVID-19 the best?
And good evening. We begin tonight with urgent news from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. And the headline is, Russian hackers got into local and state computers in America, browsed about unchecked, and stole data from at least two U.S. government servers. The New York Times further reports U.S. intelligence, quote, pieced together details of what they believe are Russia's plans to interfere in the presidential race in its final days or immediately after the election on November 3rd. However, the FBI reports it has no evidence yet that the integrity of elections data has been compromised. We'll hear from a cyber expert on this coming right up. This on debate night in America, Joe Biden and President Trump in their final scheduled face-off and what could be their last appearance on the same stage. We're less than 2 hours away now. The stage set in Nashville, a live look inside here. And for the first time, the debate commission will mute and cut off a candidate's mic while the other candidate is in 2 minutes of private time. On the way to the debate, Joe Biden said that he hopes President Trump plays by the rules, including getting tested for COVID beforehand. The White House reports the president did test negative on Air Force One during that flight to Nashville. Already, nearly 48 million Americans have voted across the nation. That's more than one-third of the total vote in 2016. The Real Clear Politics average of the polls shows the former vice president with a nearly 8-point lead nationally and a clear edge in a number of crucial swing states. The two men meet tonight before moderator Kristen Welker of NBC News on that stage in Nashville where COVID-19 cases in that city are surging up 40% in just the past 2 weeks. NBC News chief White House correspondent Hallie Jackson kicks off our coverage live from the debate hall at Belmont University. Hallie, how goes?
Shep, goes well here. Obviously a big night, busy night, and lots to cover, my friend.
Two specific strategies. Let's start with Vice President Biden's.
So the Biden campaign wants to make sure that the focus remains on what Joe Biden has been talking about for months now, Shep, and that is the administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic that you just referenced with those numbers here in Tennessee. So watch for Biden to continue to try to push that message and to do a lot of what he did in that first debate where he turned to the camera, right? We saw those moments where the former vice president turned away from President Trump, turned away from the moderator, and delivered a message to American voters. The campaign, people close to Biden, thought that was effective. They thought that helped get his message across. So you're likely to see something similar this time. And I will tell you that the Biden camp is ready for the attacks that they predict will be coming from President Trump, specifically related to Joe Biden's son, Shep.
And, you know, we keep hearing that President Trump, who aides have said is sometimes difficult to manage, he wants to do things his own way, but that he has a specific and different strategy tonight, too.
Well, I don't know if he has the specific and different strategy, Shep, but people around him, based on our reporting, want him to have a different strategy, which is to interrupt less, basically. There's this thinking inside the heads of people close to the president that if the president let Joe Biden speak, that it opens up the potential for Joe Biden to potentially stumble or to make some kind of a gaffe that President Trump could then capitalize on. Of course, that doesn't happen unless the president lets the former vice president actually sort of have his time to discuss. That said, the president has also been very clear, and I talked with a person in the campaign today who made very clear that if the president is unhappy with something Joe Biden is saying, or if the president feels like Biden is misrepresenting him or his record, he will jump in. What I'm wondering about is how much that muted microphone thing is going to actually stop the president from trying to interrupt in those first couple of minutes of each segment, because, of course, the mics won't be muted the whole time, only for the first 4 minutes total of each segment to give each candidate time for some uninterrupted talk, Shep.
The debate on NBC coming up in 2 hours. Thank you. Debates haven't moved the polls much over the years, really, but This time around, well, it's 2020, so anything can happen. Steve Kornacki on the president's first debate polling setback.
Well, Shep, we're always asking, do debates matter? But of course, one of the reasons the president is running from behind late in this campaign is because the first debate this year did matter. This is what the polling looked like coming into that first debate at the end of September. Trump was trailing by about 6 points to Joe Biden. A week later, after that first debate, Biden's lead had grown to basically 10 points. And the lowest moment so far in the polling for Trump's reelection campaign came right after that first debate. So Trump running from behind, final debate, election closing in. Can debates this late in the presidential campaign cycle matter? Well, the last two elections, we've had late debates, too. And guess what? There was some change in the polling after them. Famously, 2016, this is what the polling looked like between Clinton and Trump heading into their final debate. It was right around now in 2016. And of course, Trump, in the final 2 weeks of that campaign, he's the one who gained, closed that gap nationally against Hillary Clinton, of course, won the popular vote. Doesn't always benefit the Republican, though. Worth remembering, if you went back 8 years ago, this was the seen in the polling going into the final debate. Remember this, Mitt Romney actually led by a fraction of a point going into their last debate against Barack Obama, but it was Obama in the final couple weeks of that campaign. That is the one who grew in the polling. Romney is the one who shrunk, and Obama, of course, was reelected. So we've had two late debates in the last two elections, and the polls did change slightly, but critically, in both of them, Shep.
Steve, thanks. New reporting indicates many U.S. intelligence officials are far more concerned about Russia than Iran interfering in the 2020 election. This comes after the director of national intelligence held a news conference, or at least made a statement in this news hour last night, accusing Iran of sending threatening emails to Democratic voters, telling those Democrats vote for Trump or else. The DNI claiming during that hour that Iran's meddling was meant to damage President Trump. The Iranian government denies any involvement, not surprisingly, denies any election interference, and calls it a desperate attempt by the Trump administration to question the outcome of the U.S. election in advance. Further evidence suggests that the Democratic voters were the ones targeted. NBC's Ali Arouzi is in Tehran on reaction from there.
Tehran is vehemently denying all accusations, saying that unlike the United States, Iran doesn't interfere in the elections of other countries, demanding the U.S. ends what they call vicious and dangerous accusations against Iran, accusing U.S. politicians of cooking up a scenario to undermine the confidence of American voters. And interestingly, Shep, they all added the caveat that they don't care who the next occupant of the White House is, because policy towards Iran will remain the same regardless of the outcome of the elections. But in reality, for the regime here, Joe Biden would be the lesser of two evils, as they believe he would return to the nuclear deal and lift sanctions, whereas President Trump would only apply more pressure.
Shep? Ali Arouzi reporting from Tehran. Now, a cybersecurity company reports it found a hacker selling voter information data of nearly 150 million Americans on the dark web. A lot of this information is publicly available if you pay for it, but it does show how easily a foreign adversary can get their hands on all kinds of information to interfere in our elections. Let's turn to Sue Gordon now, former principal deputy director of national intelligence for Presidents Trump and Obama. Before that, she was the CIA's cyber czar. It's nice to see you, Sue. Thank you.
Good to see you, Shep.
How much public information is there out there to be mined, and how can it be weaponized?
So there's a lot. And not only public information, but we have so many locations where the information is. If we don't protect them well, our adversaries are going to find it. It can be weaponized not in terms of the voting themselves, but in terms of kind of creating havoc on election and where people go, what people believe, whether their names are properly activated. So it can create mischief and create chaos and disincentivize people from going to the right place. So there are certainly things that it can do. I'll tell you, this release, particularly on the Russian activity,
I was going to ask about that. That was from the top of this news hour, just to catch our viewers up. We reported on this report from the government that Russians are actively interfering right now. They've hacked into computers. No evidence that they've compromised election systems. But what do you know of these particular hackers and what they're capable of doing?
Yeah, This is why the intelligence community worries so much about Russia. They are a very capable, very expert. You know, these are the descendants of the KGB. This is a very accomplished set of actors, and they have a whole toolkit that they can use. So the fact that they actually penetrated some networks, walked around in them, stole some data, that just is an incredibly concerning, albeit not surprising, view of what Russia can do. And that's why we worry so much about them. I really do want to highlight what the FBI and CISA says. There is a difference between getting into business networks and the voter registration networks and being in the election, actual right. election infrastructure. So there still is that gap there, but a lot of things can be done when you have this capable a service having this kind of access.
Sue Gordon, great to talk to you again. Thank you.
You too. Thanks, Jeff.
Judge Amy Coney Barrett is now one step closer to a seat on the Supreme Court. All 12 Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee voted today to approve Judge Barrett. Now the full Senate expected to vote on her confirmation on Monday. Democrats were a no-show for the hearing today. Only lasted about an hour. Instead, they held this news conference out in front of the Capitol on the steps. The minority leader, Chuck Schumer, calling the process illegitimate. If the Senate does confirm Judge Barrett, which we fully expect, there will be a 6-3 conservative majority on the court. A Colorado wildfire has exploded in size, growing more than 150 square miles in a single day. They call this one the East Troublesome Fire, and it's earned its name. Started burning last week, but strong winds overnight lit it up. The local sheriff says it's ripping through 6,000 acres an hour.
It's bad. It's really bad.
The fast-moving fire forcing an entire town to evacuate. Grand Lake, home to roughly 400 people, emptied. It's about a two-hour drive north and west of Denver. Cops rushing door-to-door helping people get out there. Right now, the fire's just said to be 5% contained, that from the U.S. Forest Service. It's one of several major fires burning there, includes the Cameron Peak Fire, the largest wildfire in Colorado state history. COVID Watch now, big announcements from the FDA. The first coronavirus treatment in the United States is now approved. Happened today. Plus, the unique step toward building the public's trust for a vaccine.
The FDA pulls back the curtain on the COVID-19 vaccine, seeking outside input on some high-risk questions.
It will truly result in an avalanche of evictions.
Renters are struggling. So are landlords. But what happens when eviction bans expire? Plus, the pandemic boom for the plastics industry.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith, back in 60 seconds.
COVID Watch and the fall surge hitting America hard. The CDC reports COVID cases are increasing in 75% of our country. Average daily cases up for 15 days in a row, increasing more than 30% over that period. That's from Johns Hopkins. In the Midwest, they're bearing the brunt of this surge. Ohio recording more than 2,400 daily COVID cases, the highest number that state has ever reported on a single day. Its neighbors in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Illinois all seeing at least a 20% spike in daily average cases over the past week. And in the past few hours, the FDA approved remdesivir as a coronavirus treatment. It's now the first and only fully approved treatment for COVID-19 in the country. CNBC's Meg Terrell on how the FDA is ensuring that any vaccine approved will be safe.
The FDA's outside panel of advisors is considered a key safeguard in getting a COVID-19 vaccine to market in a process that's been the fastest in history.
People think that there are critical safety guidelines or efficacy guidelines are being curtailed, but that's really not the story.
Today, a discussion of what's to come, the data needed to support clearing a vaccine, how to track safety during the initial rollout, one idea, a daily text message from the CDC, and with the leading vaccines requiring two shots several weeks apart, how to ensure people get the right one the second time. Regulators plan to track this both electronically and with paper cards. But a major unanswered question, how many people will be willing to get the shots in the first place? Concerns range from the speed of the process to distrust in government and the healthcare system. A CNBC Change Research poll finds just 40% of Americans say they're willing to get a COVID-19 vaccine. Now, Shep, the panel today didn't discuss any specific vaccine candidates, but we're just about a week and a half away from potentially seeing the first data from these major trials on whether these vaccines work and how well.
We'll look for that. Meg, thanks so much. Does your mask protect you from COVID or just the people around you? Researchers in Japan have answered that question for the very first time. They used two automated mannequins, the one you see here, the mannequin heads, and the actual virus, the infected mannequin made to cough on the other. And here's the result. With one of these cloth masks that you see everybody wearing, 17% less of the virus is inhaled by the person wearing it. With these blue masks, the hospital type ones that come like that, 47% less. So they work better than the cloth. And then there's the N95 or KN95. They fit tight. They have the room to breathe in the first. 70% of everything you might inhale is filtered out. The team from Tokyo's Institute of Medical Science says masks alone will not stop the spread, but they're a big help. And people should do more to protect themselves, like socially distance and wash up every time. That empty middle seat on Southwest Airlines during the pandemic, that's about to get sold again in Southwest Airlines. The company making the announcement today, the problem is money. Southwest is struggling and mightily. The CEO there says it could be 10 years before business travel returns to pre-pandemic levels. 10 years? The airline reporting its biggest loss ever, burning through $16 million every day. And believe it or not, that's an improvement. It had been $23 million a day. Many airlines spend just as money they're spending just to stay in operation with little revenue coming in. Planes are parked, all the carriers really. They have nowhere to go in many cases, barely any demand. American, the world's largest airline, I should say, is really in worse shape. Losses are mounting, $2.5 billion in the quarter alone, hemorrhaging cash, burning through $44 million on average every day. Better than the $58 million American was burning last quarter. Improvement in the COVID era, quite a thing. CNBC's Phil LeBeau is here. Phil, Southwest no longer keeping the middle seat open. Could that hurt its business, or what's the thinking?
I don't think it's going to hurt the business too much, Shep. The bottom line is this. I think there may be some people who enjoy having that extra space when they get on a Southwest flight, but they're going to continue flying. If they're going to hold off on a flight because of this move where there's going to be somebody sitting next to them, they probably were not real confident about flying in the first place. I think Southwest will be fine. And by the way, you still have Alaska and Delta that are keeping the middle seat open, but that's eventually going to change for them as well.
Yeah, probably so. The airlines are disinfecting. We did a whole documentary on this, but there's some stats now on whether this is really working.
Well, a new study that was done by Boeing where they actually took a virus similar to COVID-19 and they put it on different surfaces on a plane. And then they tested whether you spray disinfectant, whether or not you have the UV light wand, whether you wipe down the different surfaces. Does it really get rid of the virus? And the results show, according to the University of Arizona, yes, they do get rid of the virus. So these tactics are working, according to the scientists. Of course, you and I both know if somebody's feeling a little hinky about getting on board because of the virus, it's going to be hard to convince them.
Phil LeBeau in Chicago. Thanks, Phil. Now a story of survival. Actually, two stories. A pair of sisters more than 100 years young, and both of them beat COVID. Here's CNBC's Contessa Brewer.
Going hot. Ooh, going hot. Ooh.
You're looking at one tough woman tangoing at 108 years old.
You okay, Anna?
Yeah.
All right.
Meet Anna Del Priore, a survivor of two global pandemics. Anna's family says she caught the flu in 1918, the deadliest of all time. But she beat it at just 6 years old. And more than 100 years later, she got COVID-19 in May at her nursing home in Middletown, New Jersey. She battled it for 6 weeks.
What was it like to see her suffering from coronavirus?
We all felt so bad for her, but she bounced back.
Bounced back all right and conquered coronavirus.
I'm sure there are a lot of people, Miss Anna, who want to know what the secret is to living so long.
To be honest and kind, believe in God, all the good stuff.
60 miles away in Queens, New York, Anna's younger sister, Helen. She's 105. In March, she also got COVID-19 and had to isolate.
I miss you, Nick.
I know, Mom. I miss you, too.
Her son and granddaughter couldn't visit.
When we heard that she had the coronavirus, I thought that was it. I thought this was the end.
I didn't.
And she's so strong.
I said, there's no way this is bringing her down. Not after all these years.
Nicole was right. Grandma made a full recovery.
It is possible that these are America's toughest sisters. Yeah. Miss Helen, how often are you exercising?
I do it every night before I go to bed. I kick my legs. I go up and down, 10 times.
All your life, you watch what you ate.
I miss my Italian food.
Oh, you do?
Spaghetti and meatballs.
The sisters FaceTimed on their birthday last month.
Hey!
Yes, they were also born on the same day, 3 years apart. After the call, friends and family rolled by in a car parade outside Anna's nursing home. The birthday girl took it all in from her giant throne.
I felt so important.
The takeaway is to be joyous and to find like the happiness in life.
It's clear these sisters are intent on joy, smiling and dancing through life. For the news, I'm Contessa Brewer.
Absolutely love it. Contessa, thanks so much. Well, they're digging for the truth of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre now. And they've made an enormous discovery. We'll talk to one of the archaeologists working to uncover a lost piece of history. And it's clear plexiglass is having a moment. Teachers, musicians, even Santa's getting into the game. Plexiglass. Oh, 2020. Millions of Americans are relying on government aid to make ends meet these days. The new jobs report, top CNBC's On the Money. 787,000 Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week. A big number, but it's an improvement. It's down 55,000 from the week before, below 800,000 for the first time since the early days of the pandemic. New safety measures at Target. The retailer wants to get shoppers back at its stores, especially during the lucrative holiday season. So it's making changes, no-touch payments, shorter checkout lines, more drive-up and pickup spots, and get this, you can even make a reservation at Target. All this designed to make shoppers and workers feel safer. First it was Tab, now Coke is getting rid of 200 other brands. Specific names not announced. The company says it's choosing to focus on its most profitable products like Coke Zero Sugar and Hard Seltzer. The strategy designed to kickstart growth. Global sales have slowed with restaurant closures, bars shut down, and movie theaters shuttered. Sales are lagging. On Wall Street, stocks getting a lift after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pointed to progress on coronavirus relief talks. Chatter it is. Bank stocks led the way. The Dow 152, S&P adding 17, the NASDAQ plus 21. A unique moment on CNBC late this morning that caught our eyes and ears up in our newsroom. Two business titans, captains of industry, came on TV and admitted they screwed it all up. Jeffrey Katzenberg, former chairman of Walt Disney Studios, former CEO of DreamWorks, and Meg Whitman, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, former eBay CEO, current board member of Procter & Gamble. The two together created Quibi, and today stood honest and transparent while falling on their business swords. Their multi-billion dollar Quibi project, which they said would change the way we watch videos on our phones with quick bites and big stories, failed miserably and expeditiously. And they took the blame.
You know, in the end, I think all you can do, we can do is own it. For sure, you know, there was risk involved in it, but I think all of us expected a much better outcome, a much bigger outcome from this.
It was clear that for whatever reason, this was not going to be as successful as Jeffrey and I had hoped. And so we took stock of where we were and we said the best thing to do, the honorable thing to do, is to return money to shareholders.
For me, I got to get back up on that horse and, you know, go find the next mountain to charge up to. And it's the only thing I know how to do. And I have a lot to prove.
And they didn't blame COVID. The company did raise $2 billion from funding from major media companies like Disney, Fox, and our own parent company, NBC Universal. Also, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. According to the tech website The Information, Quibi will return about $350 million to shareholders. A Token of Love resurfaces after 15 years and a dramatic rescue caught on camera as we take a CNBC trip coast to coast. California. Firefighters jump into dark and choppy surf to save a man trapped on a cliff, this near the Golden Gate Overlook in San Francisco. The man clinging to a rock as rescue crews try to get to him, but you see the waves keep tossing them all around. They finally reach the guy and get him up on a paddleboard. North Carolina. A 97-year-old woman votes for the first time. Lottie Ramsey says with everything going on in the world, she knew she had to show up at the polls.
I got a good mind. Thank God he has blessed my mind.
Ms. Lottie could have done curbside voting in Richlands, about an hour's drive from Wilmington, but she says she wanted to watch her ballot go right into the machine. Kentucky. A construction crew finds an engagement ring 15 years after a woman lost it. Workers say they were remodeling a home in Boyd County when they spotted it, kind of wedged between a wall and a vanity. The homeowner says she looked for it for weeks, but eventually gave up back in the day. Now, it's back on her finger. Massachusetts. It's a boy. The first male gorilla ever born at the Franklin Park Zoo in Boston. And he's a big one, weighing just more than 6 pounds. Baby gorillas usually weigh in 3 to 5 pounds. No name yet, but Mama Kiki and baby TBD are bonding well on this CNBC trip, coast to coast. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour, time for the top of the news. 90 minutes now from the final presidential debate. The candidates trying to get out their voters with just 12 days to go until the election. A record number of people already voting. By some in person, some by mail. That's from U.S. projections numbers. The new number, 47 million votes cast so far, 20 million just in the last 4 days. In Arizona, more than 1 million people have voted. One key target group, young people, who so rarely turn out in big numbers. NBC's Vaughn Hilliard on the top story at the bottom of the hour with what he's hearing from college students in a state where the polls, some of them, open today.
Shep, we're here in Maricopa County, which encompasses Phoenix's expansive suburbs, including the campus here of Arizona State University. The voters in this largely suburban county make up about 60% of the state's electorate, and it has been a Republican stronghold over the last decades. But so far, data is showing that Democrats are voting early at a particularly high rate here. And a great number of those are folks who have never voted or voted infrequently. And I want to introduce you to Luis, one of those voters here. He's a sophomore at Arizona State, and this is his first election.
I do think Arizona could turn blue. I do believe that, especially with us being Gen Z and kind of half millennials, now we are able to vote as a minority.
Latinos now make up one-third of the population here, and its young voting population, like Luis, is only increasingly diverse. Right now, polling shows Joe Biden with a 40-point edge among Arizona voters 18 to 29 years old, and the Democrat has maintained the heavy backing of the state's Latino population as well. Keep in mind, over the last decade in Arizona, no candidate for governor or senator or president has won statewide here while losing Maricopa County. Where Maricopa County goes, the state goes. But that's why you saw President Trump earlier this week in the northern part of the state, trying to juice his turnout in rural Arizona and make up for those anticipated deficits here in the suburbs. Shep?
Thanks very much, Vaughn. Arizona is one of those key states that could help decide the election. These swing states are generally tightly contested and less predictable, and where President Trump made a lot of ground against Clinton back in 2016. Kornacki's back now. Steve, how critical are these races this time around?
Yeah, absolutely critical. Let's look at it this way from the president's standpoint. What would it take for Trump to get reelected? Remember, he got 306 electoral votes. He's trying to hold on to at least 270 in 2016. Can he hold on to that? So what you've got here, these are all states that Donald Trump won in 2016, Arizona among them. And they are arranged right now from where Trump is in the weakest position in the polls to where Trump is the strongest. You see, he's trailing in just about all of these states. So looking at it from this standpoint, he got 306 electoral votes. What would it take to hang on to at least 270? Well, if he loses Michigan, where he's down by seven now, knocks him down to 290. How about Wisconsin? Again, down nearly seven. If Trump loses there, he's down to 280. Remember, they do it by congressional district in Nebraska. The polling there has been bad for Trump as well. If he loses that, it's an electoral vote off his count. Brings you down to the next closest state. Trump trails by just over five in Pennsylvania. If he doesn't reverse that, boom, that would be your tipping point state. That's what would knock Trump under 270. That's what would put Biden over it. So one way to look at all these different swing states is the line right now is right here. Trump has to get Pennsylvania, or he's down by just over five, and he's got to get everything south of here as well. If he gets Pennsylvania and everything, Arizona included, underneath, that would be enough to hang on. But he can't lose more than that. That would knock him under.
Pennsylvania, we may not know that till the weekend. Steve, wow, thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Plexiglass. Plexiglass is everywhere, isn't it? Restaurants, salons, schools, it's at the drugstore. It's like everywhere. Officials at Purdue University in Indiana say they ordered 5 miles of plexiglass to protect students and teachers. And look at this. Santa's coming to town. He's got plexi, too. Preet-owned malls gave us this mock-up of what talking to Santa will look like maybe this year. Oh, 2020, the year of the plexiglass boom. Here's CNBC's Rahel Solomon.
Tonight, Kamala Harris and Mike Pence came face to face, though, through plexiglass.
Plexiglass
taking center stage at the vice presidential debate earlier this month. Just another sign of the growing demand for sheets of plastic.
I personally feel safer with the dividers in place.
In West Point, New York, at the U.S. Military Academy, dividers are popping up all over campus.
We did survey our students. Given the option to have a divider or a mask, they strongly prefer the dividers.
Colonel Mike Benson is Director of Mechanical Engineering at West Point. His team did a study on plastic dividers and desk spacing, and he says the results were promising.
The dividers do seem to have a net improvement in terms of the classroom airflow.
The clear panels also making things safer for the West Point band. Here they are performing for the Commander-in-Chief in June.
To be able to come together and play, especially for a graduation where the president comes, is pretty historic.
The acrylic sheets at West Point coming from Shore Plastics in Baltimore.
We've never seen physics in 41 years to be like this.
Owner Larry Shore says business tripled over last year. New demand surging from dental offices, school districts, even the House of Representatives. Also in Baltimore, the factory floor is buzzing at Laird Plastics.
We've bent the sneeze guard at 90 degrees so we can make an L shape.
We do everything from round corners to drill holes to do cutouts for pass-throughs.
Manager Brandy Campbell says her team pulls 17-hour days to keep up, turning acrylic sheets into everything from sneeze guards to jury box dividers. While the acrylic plastic boom's been great for business, Larry Shore says he'd give up all his pandemic profits in a heartbeat.
I'd be more than willing to give every penny of it back if we could make all this go away right now.
For the news, I'm Rahel Solomon.
The search for historical truth in Tulsa, Oklahoma. A mass grave found during a dig for victims of the 1921 race massacre there. Why it could be months before we know who they were. And protests over police brutality. Complaints of violence. A movement led by young people. But this one is not in America. And in this one, a dozen people are dead.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 90 seconds.
Archaeologists have made a startling discovery, a mass grave in Tulsa, what they believe to be the remains of victims of the 1921 race massacre there. At least 12 bodies in a spot the city had no record of anyone buried. Nearly a century ago, a white mob attacked and wiped out the area in Tulsa known as Black Wall Street. Experts estimate the mob killed as many as 300 African Americans and wounded some 800 more. Local coverage now. Sierra Pizarro of NBC station KJRH live on scene. Sierra, how's the city of Tulsa coming to grips with this?
This is an incredible moment for the Tulsa community, one that's acknowledged by Mayor G.T. Bynum today.
I'm thankful for the citizens of Tulsa who have reversed
nearly a century of the conventional wisdom of this being something that we don't want to talk about and that we just want to put behind us and pretend like it never happened. This generation of Tulsans is not doing that.
Mayor Bynum visited this site yesterday and today. He's not the only one. Crowds have gathered all week here at Oaklawn Cemetery to watch the work being done here. Some say they're even surprised that the investigation has come to this point where they're actually digging up soil in search of the victims of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. Descendants have even stopped by. One of them tells me he didn't know his family was impacted by the attack until later in life, and that's because his family, he says, was so traumatized by what happened. They didn't want to talk about it, Shep.
Yeah. Sierra Pizarro, thanks so much with the excavation right behind her. Let's turn to Dr. Carrie Stackelback. Carrie is an archaeologist at the University of Oklahoma working on the excavation and with us live. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
How stunned were people to find that this was there and no one had any clue?
Well, so I think absolutely it's definitely come as a surprise. It is not unusual to encounter unmarked graves in a cemetery, especially a historic cemetery, but certainly to have encountered this number of unmarked graves in the large trench that we've excavated is quite surprising. Yes.
Carrie, you were just in a meeting, I understand, with descendants of the massacre victims. What did they say about this dig?
They have questions for us. They're clearly very interested. I think they're quite pleased with the fact that we have made this step and that we're making progress. But understandably, everybody is starting to ask questions about the next steps and where do we go from here.
What are the next steps? I mean, are they planning on exhuming the bodies or what?
That is, the next step is what we are going to propose, is that exhumation would be the appropriate thing for us to do. However, we have a series of logistical issues that we have to address in order to get to that point, and that will take us a certain amount of time for us to actually get through all of that, including getting the appropriate court order that would allow us to perform the exhumation. And then we would also want to make sure that we are appropriately addressing the need to maintain the preservation of those remains while we undertake the analyses, the specialized analyses that will allow us to confirm if, in fact, we are looking at race massacre victims.
Well, is there an idea about whether people will ever be identified? Is there a process that's reliable all these years later?
There is a process. So DNA is available for as one technique to try and identify.
If there's a match from back way back then,
but that would be an extremely challenging process, and this we understand. And that's part of that logistical consideration that I referenced earlier. Yeah. Has to do with that. One of those things is that we have to put together an appropriate strategy to actually try to even accomplish that. And there are a number of things that would have to be addressed in order to do so. Obtaining the samples from the skeletal remains is somewhat easier. Doesn't mean that it isn't itself complicated, but that is quite a bit easier than the other end of that, which is to then identify an individual who would provide a sample that can be identified as a match to our skeletal remains, especially when we're talking about multiple generations on.
Sure. So important for those families, and really just to make sure that history is recorded properly, an important project. Dr. Carrie Stackelback, thank you so much. There are reports of a massacre in Nigeria. Amnesty International says government forces have killed a dozen people. On Tuesday night, as they report it, soldiers fired shots at protesters at a toll bridge in Lagos, the country's financial hub. The organization says it found the remains of 12 people, hundreds injured from that attack. It's accusing the police and the military. The government denies it all. The protests are the latest demonstrations in Africa's most populous nation. Thousands of Nigerians flooding the streets to demand an end to police brutality. And the government announced this week it's ending a special anti-robbery squad, widely known as SARS. So controversial. That group accused of many cases of torture and murder. Beyonce posted this message on her Instagram page, #EndSARS, shared by Beyonce and other celebrities, including Rihanna and Drake and many more. A major bank robbery in Eastern Europe, plus an update on the teacher who was beheaded, as we go around the world in 80 seconds.
France, prosecutors charging seven people in the death of a teacher who was beheaded. The suspects include two students. Authorities say the killer paid those students around $350 to ID the teacher. Samuel Paty murdered last week after he showed his class cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Police later shot and killed the attacker. Memorials growing across the country. Georgia, dozens held hostage at a bank. Security cameras show a gunman threatening people before karate kicking a computer. The armed man let 40 people go, but he escaped the bank with three hostages and a reported $500,000. He later freed the rest of the hostages near a forest. Brazil, check out this mobile flower shop. The business owner cruises around Rio selling flowers from her lime green 1969 Volkswagen Beetle. She says she loves helping customers make the right pick among her orchids and roses and potted plants. Italy. Meet Pistachio, the puppy born with green fur. How that happened? Experts say it's due to a pigment that also creates the green color when you get bruises. But no worries, they say the green will eventually fade away as we go round the world in 80 seconds. A deposition sealed for the last 4 years is out tonight. What Jeffrey Epstein's former girlfriend says she witnessed, and what is still being kept from the public. Plus, millions of Americans say they won't be able to make rent next month. Now landlords and renters are bracing for more evictions. She says she didn't ever see anything inappropriate. The words of Ghislaine Maxwell, the woman accused of helping Jeffrey Epstein traffic and sexually abuse underage girls. Tonight, we're getting the first look at a 400-plus page deposition her attorneys fought to keep sealed. A judge ruled that it should be public, and most of it anyway. NBC's Stephanie Gosk with that story.
Jeffrey Epstein's associate Ghislaine Maxwell, in her own words, calling accuser Virginia Roberts Giuffre a liar, an exaggerator, a fantasist, and absolutely true, terrible person. Maxwell's deposition, unsealed by the court today, was taken in 2016 as part of a defamation lawsuit filed by Giuffre, who says Maxwell recruited her and other underage girls to have sex with Epstein. In the deposition, Maxwell repeatedly denies the allegation, her anger at times bursting through. Giuffre's attorney says Ms. Maxwell very inappropriately and very harshly pounded our law firm table. I ask she take a deep breath and calm down. The 58-year-old pleaded not guilty to sex trafficking underage girls and perjury earlier this year and is being held without bail. Federal prosecutors accuse her of lying during this deposition. Portions are redacted, including names. At one point, Maxwell is asked about an incident in her London townhouse, the details similar to sexual assault allegations Giuffre has made against Prince Andrew, which he has repeatedly denied. When apparently asked about this photo, she questions its authenticity, while not denying it could be her home. She says Giuffre is lying about the assault, telling the attorneys, she then characterized things that took place in my bathroom in the bathtub itself. The tub is too small for any type of activity whatsoever. Last year, Giuffre responded to Maxwell's denials.
She doesn't want to be held accountable for this. And in her mind, I believe she doesn't think that what she did was wrong. That's the kind of evil monster she is.
Tonight, Giuffre's attorneys say this deposition is only a small part of the evidence against Maxwell, promising much more at trial.
Maxwell is being held at a federal detention facility in Brooklyn. Her trial isn't until next summer. If she's found guilty on all these charges, she faces up to 35 years in prison. Shep?
Stephanie, there's no disaster relief deal in Washington, still no stimulus plan. And with Congress likely to go home on Monday and not return before the election, everything else is just cheap talk. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of people did not pay their rent last week. Those are the new numbers from the Apartment Industry Show. And a census report found that 10% of renters have zero confidence, none at all, that they'll be able to pay next month. That's nearly 6 million Americans. The CDC used an emergency order to ban evictions through the month of December. But soon, landlords could be left holding the bag, and renters, unless something really big happens, could go homeless. Here's CNBC's Diana Olick.
Taylor Denchfield has been buying rental properties since he was a teenager. He learned from his father, who advised him, as a landlord, be firm but fair. He says he's doing a lot of that these days.
And we've tried to work with the tenants as best we could to keep them
floating in their house and on a payment plan that works for them.
Denchfield owns seven small multifamily properties, and he now has more than twice as many delinquent tenants as before the pandemic. A new eviction ban imposed by the CDC to slow the spread of COVID only made that worse.
When evictions began to resume in the area, a lot of tenants suddenly started paying off their back balances that weren't paying before. When that new moratorium was announced, suddenly we saw payments that were starting to come back in go and stop again.
So why is that?
It's taking away the incentive to pay. If we can't be evicted, then why pay?
What's also frustrating for landlords is they know that if the non-paying tenants moved out, they would have plenty of demand from tenants who want to move in.
We have yet to see any robust federal financial assistance for renters or for landlords who are having to make ends meet while they're not being paid.
Law professor Emily Benfer created the COVID-19 housing scorecard with Princeton's Eviction Lab. It tracks evictions nationally. She says the CDC moratorium is necessary to keep renters physically safe, but it is not the solution.
It is truly just forestalling the problem for a few months. It will result in an avalanche.
Now, just last week, the CDC updated its moratorium, saying landlords can start the legal eviction process now, but just can't remove the tenants. That means come January, Shep, those tenants could be out on the street immediately.
Awful, Diana, and such a sign of the times that on the same day we get these rental numbers, we get news of record home sales.
Yeah, today the realtors reported September home sales soared to a 14-year high and prices hit a new record because of that demand. And it really shows the increasing divide between the haves and the have-nots in this pandemic,
Shep. Yep, the winners and the victims. Thanks so much, Diana. Well, the Westminster Dog Show. Here's some good news. It's getting three new breeds this year. But the show won't be at the world's most famous arena this time around. Apparently, Madison Square Garden is not the best place for doggy distancing. Where the show's headed, and the details of these new breeds that you'll see this year. And Charlie Brown and crew coming to a streaming service near you. If you don't have a streaming service, good grief. Breeds set to debut at Westminster Dog Show, and here they are. I can't say those names without further making a fool of myself, but the pictures are awesome. Sadly, they won't be in Madison Square Garden like normal. Thanks, COVID. Next year's show outdoors. Westminster reports they're moving to a riverside estate 30 minutes north of Manhattan. That wouldn't be comfortable in the middle of the winter, so the outdoor show will happen in mid-June 2021. Time to drop some space knowledge. Tuesday, NASA managed to land the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft on an asteroid hurtling through space, grab some rocks and dirt, and then start the 200 million mile journey back to Earth. Well, now we have footage of the moment it all went down, the hope that the split second touchdown grabbed enough rocks and dirt to bring back to Earth, and that those samples will give clues as to what the universe was like 4.5 billion years ago. Yay, science. It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, but it won't be on TV this year. Not broadcast or cable, anyway. Snoopy, Charlie Brown, and Peppermint Patty, the pumpkin carols going digital. If you have an Apple TV Plus account, it's all included. Everyone else will have to get a sneak peek at a time to be determined. Don't know exactly when. Same for Thanksgiving show and even a Charlie Brown Christmas. First time in 60 years, no peanuts on free TV at the holidays. 60 seconds left on a race to the finish. Cue the orchestra. COVID surge is raging across the nation. An alarming spike in Ohio. The governor there reporting nearly 2,500 cases since yesterday. The most Ohio has had in a single day since the pandemic began. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security report Russian hackers have been breaking into local and state government computer systems in the U.S. The New York Times reports they were able to get into some election administration systems and have access to voting information. They're concerned about the vote. The feds say so far there's no evidence to date that the integrity of the election's data has been compromised. And we're about an hour away from the final presidential debate before the big election. This time around, the debate commission only putting up one mic at a time during setup questions. And now you know the news of this Thursday, October the 22nd, 2020. I'm Shepard Smith. Follow us on Twitter at The News on CNBC. And we'll see you back here same time tomorrow. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.